Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Later, Steph Curtis's five things to read, listen, and to watch. But first, our summer work series continues this hour as we look at changes the Me Too movement has brought to the workplace. Is reporting misconduct more common and more accessible? What do you do when you work in a toxic environment? Earlier this spring, the Pew Research Center polled on the results of Me Too, and I want to hear what you have to say about this. I found this surprising. Pew discovered that a majority of Americans still believe that men can get away with sexual harassment and discrimination at work. 46% said they were worried that women still aren't believed, that there's a credibility gap. So I want to hear from you this morning. Do you think women still face an uphill battle when it comes to credibility on allegations of sexual harassment? If you're a younger worker, let's say 35 and under, do you think things have significantly changed for men and women in the workplace? How have they changed for you? So for everyone, I'd like to hear you this morning on that credibility gap that is turning up in some polling about Me Too. And then if you're a younger worker, been in the workforce, I don't know, you're 35 years old and younger, do you think things have significantly changed for men and women in the workplace, and how have they changed for you? Phone number here, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Robert Sutton is with us. He's a professor at Stanford and author of Designing Organizational Change. And Bob, which you prefer Bob, is that right?
Sure.
Welcome. Really good to have you with us today.
Nice to be there, Carrie.
Danielle Packett is with us. She's a Washington Post reporter who focuses on labor issues, and she's with us from D.C. And Danielle, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Carrie.
Danielle, the Pew survey surprised me, and maybe it's just because I've done a lot of shows and had a lot of conversations about this, but I wonder if it fits with your reporting that women are still concerned about being believed, even though we are more educated about this.
Well, that's absolutely true. And we got some more evidence on that from the head of the EEOC, which enforces such complaints, last week. Victoria Lipnick told me that in the first few months of 2018, the agency has not received more complaints about sexual harassment than it did last year. Huh. And no one really knows quite why yet. They want to do more surveys, get more data. But one theory is that people are still afraid to speak up. They fear the extremely real possibility of retaliation, of getting in trouble. The other possibility is employers are just settling these matters faster because they know in this climate it looks extremely bad to be that company that allows such behavior to fester.
Bob, what's your sense about what's happening inside workplaces on this? Do you have a sense that there are people who still feel intimidated to speak up, or that, as Danielle suggested, it might be that workplaces are managing this differently?
I would be shocked if organizations could change this quickly and magically these problems would go away. I suspect, as has always been, when people feel as if they're treated badly, there's a lot of risk to speak out, and they only do so when they're part of a larger group that is supporting them. And so with all the examples that we've seen, you can see it isn't that if one person speaks out, they get squished. There was just a guy from Tesla who spoke out. He gets squished. It needs to be part of a larger group of people who support them. That tends to be the way that any sort of workplace abuse comes to the fore and is an effective battle back.
It's interesting what you've just said, because we know that in reporting some of these Me Too stories, that was the difficult bar, right? To get enough people who experienced it, who had stories to tell, to be willing to tell it openly.
Or tremendous documentation. Remember Margaret Carlson at Fox News, after years of complaining, she actually recorded Roger Ailes without his permission for months and months, and finally had such good evidence, in addition to a mass of women reporting, that finally even Fox News admitted they made a mistake. So you got to have great evidence, and having a little power like Margaret Carlson helps too.
Let me take a call here from Tatiana in St. Paul. Tatiana, what's your experience with this? Hi.
Well, I work as a flight attendant, and so I kind of work with pilots on a regular basis, and it's pretty common for you to receive sexual advances on a pretty regular basis. So I don't really think that. And for our industry, it's more taboo to speak out. There's definitely rules in place, and they would be, you know, reprimanded if you did speak out. But if you get caught, or, you know, you become that person that said something, then you have that reputation. So you just kind of put up with it because that's the way it's always been.
Why is that in the airline industry? What's your perception about why it is more difficult to speak out in that kind of a business?
I think it's just about protecting one another. You have safety concerns on a daily basis. And there just was so many things that you were allowed to do. I mean, people were partying on airplanes. I mean, you used to be able to smoke. So many things have changed. And a lot of the people that were around then are still around. So they still have that mentality that that's acceptable work practices.
Oh, I'm glad for the call. Danielle, do you find that there are some industries and kinds of businesses where nothing has changed because of Me Too?
It's hard to say who has changed because there's not much evidence that anything concrete is happening. But what I can tell you is firms in Silicon Valley, where the problem is known to be extra bad, they've started to make these policy tweaks. Uber, for example, last month announced it was ending forced arbitration,
right,
which is when a company, you know, pushes an employee into a private discussion to handle sexual harassment matters. So now the companies are free to sue employees are free to sue the company to speak publicly about mistreatment they face. Microsoft did the same thing last year, and it's just been this really slow march toward change. I can't really name other large firms that have done the same thing.
Bob, you're in California near Silicon Valley. What's your perception of what's happening in that kind of a business?
Well, my perception is, and I work with a number of the companies that have already been mentioned do cases on them and the like. And so my perception is that some companies are better than others, but Uber is really a pretty interesting case because, so I teach in the Stanford Engineering School, and Uber was known among female engineers is the worst place to go to work until very recently.
Wow.
And now it's quickly becoming known as one of the better, best places for a female engineer to go. And if you look what they went through, virtually 17 of their 18 top people are gone. They're making all sorts of massive policy changes, and still there are pockets where it's better versus worse. So it is getting better in some places, but there always have been employers that are better rather than worse for women in Silicon Valley. Google's always been pretty good. Facebook's been pretty good, and there's been other ones that are, and I won't name them, that are historically places where most women won't go. And venture capital is terrible. If you want to see sexist white males with bro cultures, I would nominate venture capital.
You know, Bobby, you've said something interesting about, you alluded to the atmosphere, I guess, that is set from the top down, because
yes,
we know what was going on with the CEO of Uber. How important does that end up being in the kind of work culture that develops, and Me Too?
So the focus of my work is generally on workplace jerks and the like, and yes,
right,
that's the main area that I've written in. And the CEO's behavior is very important because it sets the tone for how everybody else behaves, and you certainly could see that with Travis at Uber.
Mm-hmm.
And to say something positive. Well, another company that's always been very good is LinkedIn. So Reid Hoffman, who was the founding CEO, very good at sort of setting the tone for behavior. Mark Benioff also at Salesforce. So we do have CEOs who set the tone that sexist behavior, abusive behavior is inappropriate. Reed Hastings at Netflix is fantastic.
But, and
And one thing I just really want to emphasize for our more capitalist folks is all of those leaders are quite excellent capitalists. And they're very performance oriented, but sexism, racism is not acceptable around them.
You don't get the out of, well, this is the kind of culture we need to succeed in this environment, so we look the other way. No. There are examples that that's not true.
Many venture capitalists in particular do support that sort of culture implicitly or explicitly. It's a disease in the area that I live in.
Let me take some calls here to Marie in St. Paul. Hi, Marie. What's your experience with this?
Hi, Carrie. I work in the entertainment industry, primarily theater and opera, but also in the music industry and other things like that. Since the 1980s, I've always spoken up. I've always said we have the right to work in a harassment-free environment. You are creating a non-friendly environment by doing blank. And I would always call out racism, sexism, misogynist behavior, homophobic behavior, and would say you start with one and it continues. So I have always spoken up, and I have most of my life felt empowered by myself as an individual. Mm-hmm. And then with the Me Too movement, it's sort of like, wait a minute. I have experienced this. I've just spoken up again and again and again. And I've had the good fortune of having an employer back me up and say, this is unacceptable behavior. And visitors to this theater do not get to treat our employees this way.
Marie, I think that's super valuable. And you've actually picked up on something that Bob said earlier that I wanted to go back to Danielle on, which is the tone that the CEO sets, Danielle. And what I want to ask is not only a tone of we are not going to tolerate that, but how about a tone which apparently went on in a lot of companies of it's not a big deal, and you know, even if we don't have a system where reporting and accessibility to reporting works very well, that's not something that I'm going to send a signal is a high priority. You see what I'm asking?
Well, again and again, I hear you will see no change. And in fact, you'll see suffering among your staff if you don't enforce or at least try to change the entire culture to say this is not something we will accept. And in fact, this is something that will damage us economically. If you want to keep your job, you cannot practice these behaviors. It's simply not enough to have a video or one day training to tell you, you know, what not to do. When you make the argument, hey, these kind of behaviors will increase turnover, they will slow production, they, you know, they will hurt all of our paychecks, that's when people really start listening.
A conversation here this morning that's part of our work series in which we're going back to examine what the consequences have been about the Me Too movement, where we got educated, we understand more about workplace sexual harassment, but what kind of changes have actually happened? Danielle Paquette with us from The Washington Post. She focuses on labor issues, and Robert Sutton is a professor at Stanford and the author of Designing Organizational Change. That's really what we're talking about. Have organizations changed? What's happening as far as women feeling freer to report allegations of sexual harassment? Do they still face an uphill battle on credibility? We're hearing that from some surveys that Pew did and what the EEOC is saying here. I want to hear from you. As a younger worker, how much has changed for you? What do you think about this credibility issue? And for all of us, is it still an uphill battle for women to report? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000. Dave says on Twitter, yes, they most certainly do, especially in cases where the predator is a superior, and women I know have been dismissed as ambitious when they complain about his actions. So to reach me on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R, to Alyssa in Chanhassen. Hi, Alyssa. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, I'm happy, Tom. I'm happy I could be on the show.
What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking in my mind, I know for me, when I first started as a 16-year-old working in the food service industry, we're talking about women and how they're engaging in the workplace, but also I think it's important to really talk about what it's like for them as young girls when they're engaging in the workplace, because that sets the tone for them as a professional. And I know for me, it was not, to put it mildly, not the best experience. We had horrific comments that I had a superior making, and it didn't feel like it was a comfortable space for me to go forward and to actually report that.
So,
luckily, I had some very supportive parents who kind of, you know, assisted me with that. But being 15, 16, 17 in that space, how do you go forward and
wow.
that?
So this is your first experience with work where you're
this
coming
like,
up against this. Man.
Yeah, this was one of my first few jobs. And I was so excited. I was like, now I have a paycheck. This is exciting. But when you get there, you see things that are not right. And you're wondering, how can I go forward and do that? Because for us as women, it's challenging as it is. But what's it like for our young girls mm-hmm. as they're trying to navigate that and have a sense of agency? And if they're in an environment that says in the training videos, please report anything that's unjust that's taking place, but yet it is not conveying that, how can we empower them to come forward and do that? So luckily I had some amazing family who assisted me with that, but it can still be really problematic. And to be honest, for a lot of girls, it can be scarring. And for our young men who's there, it sets a tone for them to make it seem as though it's acceptable when it absolutely is not.
I think you'll be interested in what Maya called in to say, Alyssa in Grand Forks. She says, I'm a high school student, so not exactly in the workforce yet, but I already feel the effects of the boys' club. There's a clear difference between the joking and the camaraderie that my male teachers have with their male students versus what young women have access to. Bob, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm not an expert on high schools, but from the experiences of my daughters and their friends, they would say that's exactly what goes on, that the bros can get away with things that they can't get away with. And you do end up in a situation, and this applies to whether it's girls in high school or senior women executives, that when women speak out, they're much more likely to be labeled as being complainers or the B word, mm-hmm. and where men tend to get labeled as assertive. And my wife, who's been a successful senior executive for more than 20 years in law firms and now a nonprofit, she always describes how, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, that that men, when they speak out, they're viewed as confident, and when women speak out, they're being viewed as nasty, and women walk this sort of tightrope between being nice and being pushy, and it's much more complicated for women, and that's exactly what's going on in high schools, and it starts out earlier. But it isn't hopeless. There are cultures, high schools, workplaces, where it's better than that. So we can also talk about that.
Yeah, and we will. I do want to just note here that the conditioning, I think that's what Maya and Alyssa were
yep.
talking about, starts so young, right? I mean, if this is your first experience with work or you're seeing this in high school, this is embedded so deeply in our culture that you confront it at that young age. In some ways, you learn to expect it, right?
Yeah, it is interesting. It's also, although I'm not necessarily arguing for all girls' schools, but the evidence is that girls who go to all-girl high schools and don't experience that sort of essentially discrimination in programming tend to be more assertive. It's also one of the arguments why we should continue with the Girl Scouts, too, and not just have the Girl Scouts go into the Boy Scouts, where they will be taught that very often in the Boy Scouts, too.
Okay.
So there is an argument for at least early on having all-girl sort of organizations where they don't face the discrimination earlier and learn those unfortunate patterns.
I will pick up on what you said about the companies and the organizations that get this right. I'm also going to ask Danielle about Congress, where they have not gotten it right. But let me grab a call here to Greg in St. Paul. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
Hi.
I think that the role of leadership and structure are both important, but it's really important for everybody in an organization to talk about these issues, to talk about how it's not okay. And I'm not talking about specific issues as much as just in general, when you're at the water fountain or talking to people in general, just, you know, bring it up, both men and women, because it's important for all the people in an organization to talk about it. Then people who might have different ideas will say, well, whoa, Joe and Linda are saying this is not okay, and they'll start to reexamine their own ideas.
I spent
a long time in an organization where we had good leadership, but also great culture, and many women are leaders there now.
So, Greg, you're saying take it outside of the formal policy roles and really make it a place where this can be openly discussed among employees without the leadership of that company being concerned about that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If it's just viewed as, you know, something from the front office and everybody else, or so one more thing I got to do, you know, privacy training and all that kind of crap.
Oh, yeah.
It makes it seem like this is something being foisted on us. People need to understand that there's a lot of support for this in the population. And if we don't talk about it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. So, Danielle, this comes back to what you said a moment ago, and I wanted to talk about the efficacy of the training on this. A lot of companies decided the way to come back to, on Me Too and show you were doing something was require employees to be trained. I think I've read statistics that say that that's not very effective to stopping sexual harassment.
That's right. Training alone is just seen as another chore, another box to check. And really, it won't be effective, study after study shows, unless you really see that message change from the top. You need your managers outlining what kind of behaviors are unacceptable. And even beyond that, research from Harvard shows they also have to say, don't do that. We won't accept this. Also, don't do it. It's complicated because, as we've talked about earlier, everyone grows up with this bias. A lot of times people don't think they are harboring sexist thoughts, but they are. And getting it all out there requires a lot of conversation.
Bob, you were going to say?
So I agree with what is being said. So when the sexual harassment training really started coming through, I looked at the literature quite closely, and there's very little evidence it actually helps. And the only argument comes from the lawyers, and I know a lot of lawyers. I respect them. Their argument is if somebody's had sexual harassment training, it's easier to fire them after they've been bad one time. And my reaction to that is, really, that's all you've got? when it really works, and the caller was very good. It's in who do you select? Who do you get ahead? Well, do you have that star employee who's a sexist pig or simply a jerk? But you can't resist, and you promote them, and because then you're sent, or you bring in the CEO who has the same sort of reputation, and so a lot of it comes in the little things, but especially in who's selected, who's recruited, who's promoted, and who's fired.
You know, Bob, I was reading some of your writing about fighting back against a jerk boss.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you talked about this as a last resort, and you warn that you should really assess the power dynamics in that organization pretty carefully. Even in the case of sexual harassment, is fighting back, we know it's risky, but what's the advice you give about that?
Well, so I was writing more about everyday bullying,
but if you
look, which by the way isn't unlawful in almost every U.S. state, being an equal opportunity jerk is not against the law in the United States, pretty much. But if you've got a sexist or there's sexual harassment, even in that case, and we can look at the cases where they're successful. It's like one person complains and very little happens. But when a group of people get together and have documentation and push back collectively, that seems to be the cases where it actually works. It's very difficult whether you're fighting bullying, sexism, racism, for just one person alone because of the power differences.
A call here from Karen in Bloomington. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Sounds like you work in human resources. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm a human resources consultant, so
okay.
I go around to a lot of different companies and actually have had requests for harassment and sexual harassment training.
Mm-hmm.
And so I help create the training and conduct the training, and usually we start with that at a company that maybe hasn't had that in the past, and then from there we take it to more individualized performance management issues, I guess, with people, because we kind of feel like we want to start with giving people a fair notice that this behavior is not appropriate, and maybe historically it has been not addressed, but kind of now we're going to start addressing it. And then,
yeah, but Karen, what do you think when you hear us talking about the data that says that much of that training goes in one ear and out the other, that it's really,
well,
as Bob said,
it's
for the lawyers?
I agree, because they kind of check the box and say, we've done it. But I feel like then it's the follow-up to that that's important, as far as, okay, now you've kind of been put on notice that this is not appropriate, and it, you need help from human resources to come in and put together performance management individual plans for people who are doing things that are inappropriate. And if they continue to do those things, they need to be removed from the organization. So we're kind of twofold,
Karen,
I guess, with that. So,
Karen, stay with me for a second, because I want Bob, our organizational expert here, to weigh in.
Sure.
Bob?
Yeah, so I agree that training is a reasonable first step, and I think your caller has got it exactly right. You've got to get into the performance management. You've got to get into the culture. It works if you have support from the top and you don't have a situation where HR is just there to cover up the mistakes and clean up the messes of senior management who's unwilling to change their behavior or the culture in general. So I agree it's an important first step, but as she's saying, it's not enough. But you got to start somewhere, and training is a reasonable place to start.
Okay.
Firing the CEO and the top executives who are pigs is an even better place. If you look at where change has actually occurred, that's what happened at Uber and a number of other places too. So,
Karen, I bet you agree with that.
Oh yes,
you really have to take it on at the top.
I've been instrumental in making that occur at a couple places locally.
For you.
Good to have your call, Karen. Thanks much. Conversation, if you've just gotten in on this, with Danielle Paquette from The Washington Post and Bob Sutton from Stanford, who is the author of Bob, I just saw the real title of your...
Yeah, we can't say it.
Oh, they surprised me here. Anyway, check out Bob's book on Amazon.
The No Blank Rule.
Yeah, The No Blank Rule. There you go. And before I take some more calls here, Danielle, remind me what happened in Congress. They seemed to take it seriously. There was a bill and then nothing. Yes.
That's right. We haven't seen much movement since the end of May. There are folks who are concerned about one provision in this Me Too bill, and that is forcing lawmakers accused of harassment to pay those claims out of their own pocket rather than using public money. So we're kind of stuck there, but there have been mixed efforts nationwide to do things. California and New York are trying to end forced arbitration.
Right.
But we haven't seen much from our lawmakers on this issue quite yet.
Are they just, do you think they're thinking, everybody was talking about that months ago, now we're on to something else, there's no pressure to do anything? And is that true in some ways?
Well, one could say that there's some distraction out there. The country seems more focused on immigration, for example, not to call that a distraction. But there's just lots going on. It's easy for this stuff to get lost in the mix. And there's always people on Capitol Hill who are concerned about false accusations, which we know happens very rarely, but occasionally do happen, probably less than 2% of the time, research shows.
Mm-hmm.
So sexual harassment complaints can bankrupt people, they're arguing. Maybe it's not so fair.
Bob, I just have to ask you, I mean, since we were talking about the jerks, if you are sexually harassing people in your office, why shouldn't the penalty accrue to you?
I see no reason why the penalty can't accrue to you. The problem is that if I could make laws about applying sexual harassment to me, and that's what's going on.
Yeah.
So we have the wrong incentive. It's that simple.
I know. To Carolyn in Minneapolis. Hi, Carolyn. It sounds like you have some experience with this in the workplace.
Yes. Hi. In 2002, I was sexually harassed / molested by my boss's wife, and it was so egregious that they felt obligated to compensate me, and I got a six-figure severance. And the agreement was that I would leave. I would get a six-figure severance, and I would leave. And I had to sign a document that they wouldn't say anything bad about me, so my reputation wouldn't be tarnished. And likewise, they wouldn't say anything. I wouldn't say anything bad about them. Mm-hmm. So it was hush money. Hearing this conversation, I contemplate it feels harder to deal with this in a smaller setting. This was a company of 50 employees, mm-hmm. and I was also the senior director of HR.
And, wow.
Yes, and I was in charge of their sexual harassment policy and trained on it.
This blows my mind. Wow.
Yes. And so I felt that it was harder to deal with in a small company without much recourse. And so all these training issues you're discussing, I'm just contemplating in the context of a smaller company. So that's one comment I wanted to make.
Okay.
I felt I had to leave because I felt that if I stayed, that they could just let me go for no reason to get me out of the way. And then I wouldn't be able to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt stuck. And I had a perfect resume, and I had kind of groomed my resume. And I felt that the big cost to me in this was I was going to have a blemish on my resume of not staying somewhere long enough.
Right.
And I didn't know how to fix that or what to do about that. And then once I left, the owners got some training on sexual harassment and found out that the person who had done this to me had done it on such a broad scale that they couldn't train the rest of the staff on sexual harassment because it would put them in a position of a potential class action suit.
Oh my gosh.
And so they decided to not train anyone so no one would become aware of the fact that they had all been on the receiving end of this, and then the liability would be extreme.
So it sounds like, though, that when you made your complaint, you didn't realize that a lot of other people in the company had had the same experience. At that point, you couldn't gather together a bunch of voices to push back on this. I mean, is that right?
No, I think what I received was the most egregious.
Okay.
But the thing is that it was so many people, right? And one of the things in building a suit against sexual harassment is the number of incidents.
Wow. Bob, what do you make of this? Wow.
Well, the main thing I make of it is it's a good thing that the caller got out.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, honestly, things are such a mess that you can stay and fight, and thank goodness she got a settlement, which she obviously deserved. But that's always my advice. If you are in a situation and you don't have enough power and you are being treated terribly, you might get a lawyer, but it's literally like being exposed to a poison every day. Quitting is something that Americans don't like to talk about, but sometimes it's a good idea.
Carolyn, you did say that you signed a non-disclosure, right? And that worked both ways, them not saying things about you and you not saying things about them. How do you feel about that today?
I regret it. I wonder if I should go back, because I ran into the legal counsel on the street weeks after I got my severance, and he said, you could have taken us to the cleaners. You could have just cleaned up. He was kind of telling me that I had done a poor job, and then of getting as much
counsel?
As I could out of the company. And then the COO later said, oh, I want to see how you're doing and meet up and check in with you. And then he hit on me and propositioned me and tried to get me to have sex with him. And then it was not, honestly, until the Me Too movement that it dawned on me how egregious that was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the how much women don't even realize how commonplace this is, that I felt I had done a good job by myself, and now I look back and I think I didn't nearly do enough.
Danielle, I wanted to ask you about these non-disclosures. What's since the Me Too movement, we know that a lot of these cases were settled, and that seemed to be standard operating procedure to get people to sign non-disclosures. Has that changed?
That's right. You know, still the majority of workers in this country have signed some kind of agreement that they will handle things privately with their employer. Still legal, still normal. What is changing now is that companies are spending a lot more money on insurance to cover these sexual harassment claims.
Huh.
And so when you sign, when you receive your payout, almost 100% of the time, you have to sign away your right to speak about it publicly or speak about your employer. And this market, you know, these particular policies are called employment practices liability insurance. That market is projected to grow by $2.7 billion over the next year. Yeah. Oh,
that's so interesting. Bob, again, I know you're not a lawyer on this. You're an organizational expert. What's happening with companies taking – now, I hear what Danielle is saying here, but some of the more progressive companies, what's happening with this idea of nobody's ever going to talk about this and we'll be all good?
Well, as Danielle said, some of the companies, actually Uber, Microsoft, are actually getting rid of essentially the non-disclosure type agreements as part of their culture. But when it works, since we're mostly talking about the negative, but when it works, it's a message that comes through in who we recruit, in the role modeling of the executives. When something bad happens, it gets nipped in the bud. And, mm-hmm. and so one of the earlier callers also talked about that notion. And to me, that's how an effective culture works. And even in the most effective culture, there's going to be spots where bad behavior happens. So that's what one of the organizations that has very effective culture and a really tough one too is Netflix. So Netflix, in terms of any sort of harassment or lack of cooperation, people were talking about having sort of a performance improvement plan or warning. Mm-hmm. They don't do that. They just fire people on the spot, and that's part of their. If you're bad or you're incompetent, you're gone now. And
okay, Bob, but what do they? What does Netflix do? This is good to hear an example of a company that really gets it. But what do you do when it's so often you need critical mass because it's your word against somebody else's? What do they do with that?
So to the point of I think that we've heard this in every case, when it's your word against theirs, against everybody else's, and no one else is coming out to support you.
Mm-hmm.
And Fox News is a great example.
Yes.
Honestly,
yes.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a good history, and finally it came out. So my perspective is that when somebody is in a situation like that, and it can be racism, it can be bullying that's threatening, it can be ageism. There's a lot of ageism in the workplace. But if you don't have a group of people who come forward with documentation and are willing to fight, you're in a very difficult situation.
Wow.
I hate to be pessimistic, but the situation the caller was in was extraordinary.
Just unreal.
In some ways, and in other ways, completely normal in that she didn't have the information and she was alone.
Danielle, have you reported on some companies that you'd say, they really get it? They got it before Me Too. They really get it now.
I think Bob has really hit on the examples
that
I
would
usually
be a no.
use.
Okay.
Mark Benioff at Salesforce really trying to bring this stuff to the fore, like you said, and also beyond that, look at the company pay data and make sure men and women are paid equally. You know,
yeah.
Oftentimes women feel like they don't have the resources to fight because they're not paid as much as their male colleagues. That is something that I see happening in every industry.
By the way, what's the guy at Salesforce doing that you said is should be noted?
He, you know, he speaks publicly about these issues, and he does it often. I actually saw him at Davos in Switzerland earlier this year, and he's at this conference where you're supposed to talk about economic power, and he was talking about gender. But like Bob pointed out, even the best cultures have issues, so we shouldn't celebrate companies as foolproof ever. We never know what's going on behind the scenes.
Danielle, so good to have you on the show. Thank you so much for the reporting and the insight that you shared with us today. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Bob, you were just going to add there.
I was just going to agree with what Danielle was saying. And then also to point out one other thing that we haven't talked about is when you have senior executives who are women and are very powerful, it's amazing how fast things can change because people realize that politically that being bad just doesn't work. And General Motors with Mary Barra is a really good case of that.
Mm.
She's, if you look at the rest of the U.S. auto industry, it's sort of General Motors and everybody else. and she's an engineer. She's not from the so-called traditional gendered part of the occupation.
Right.
And then another one we have out here is we have Stitch Fix, which has a female CEO,
yep.
Big IPO. When that happens, right, I'm in the engineering school. Our last two deans have been women. It has an effect.
I want to say this, though. As much as I'd like to hold up women CEOs as the paragons of virtue on this, that's not always the case.
Yep. Yeah, women can be sexist or bullies just like everybody else. But still, in terms of setting the tone, it does help, I think.
Here's Sarah, who says on Twitter, maybe we're believed more now than before, but we still face the uphill battles that the harasser's career reputation are deemed more valuable than ours. And substantiating a harassment claim puts the company at risk. Yes, Bob, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, and to me, this is the test for any bad behavior, including sexual harassment, which is that will you look the other way when it's a superstar? And all too often, whether we're talking about large law firms, CEOs, you can sort of go down the list of powerful people, venture capitalists, that if they're bringing in a lot of money, people tend to look the other way. And to me, that is one of the best cultural tests, is that do you get rid of your stars who are also engaging in terrible behavior?
Mm. And Brooke says, a well-respected female HR director at a company I worked for was paid to go away and defamed through rumors and communications after she reported sexual harassment by a VP at a company event. Bob, great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for the insight. I'd love it if you'd come back sometime.
Thank you. It's
good.
A delight.
Oh, great. I want to take a call here from Cheryl in Long Prairie. Hey, Cheryl. Thanks so much for waiting. No. Oh, darn it all. We missed Cheryl. Well, maybe we can go to Maggie in Duluth. Hey, Maggie. Hi.
Oh, hi. I'm just, I just wanted to make a comment in listening to this. I have a middle schooler and I think that a lot of this begins when kids are young. She's been dress coded a few times for wearing athletic shorts to school, which are gym short quality, and they seem to be okay and not a problem to wear for gym. But on an 80-degree day, she gets sent to the principal's office and has to wait there until either I bring her something different to wear, or she wears something from the bin that they have there. In the meantime, missing school, but this is because she is, quote unquote, a distraction.
Hmm.
So rather than, discussing this issue with the boys who may or may not be commenting on a girl's, not just my daughter, but
right.
any girl's physical, what she's wearing. And this isn't, she's not wearing a bra and underwear to school. This is, gym shorts and a t-shirt. And, rather than starting there and saying that's not acceptable, then the girl ends up missing school. And somehow or another, even the young girls have put out a flyer that, why is a boy's education more important than mine?
Yeah, Maggie, let me add this from Cheryl in Long Prairie. I'm a teacher at a junior high school and middle school. I work in a K-12 school. I see this starting earlier than high school. The differences in how female teachers are treated fifth grade on, the girls know that they're treated differently.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.